Last time I spoke, some of you mentioned that you liked my background. Thanks, by the way. We love our new place. As a matter of fact, I think it's the favorite place I've ever lived in all my 47 years of marriage. But there's one thing missing, and it's right over there in that corner, or it should be. It's my Baldwin grand piano. I've joked over the years that it's my third child, and honestly, it's pretty much up there in terms of priority. It belonged to my grandfather. He bought it in Seattle in the late 1800s and took it up to Kennecott, Alaska, where he owned some silver and copper mines. And he played on it, and my father played on it as well. When my father moved down to Altadena, he brought it with him in the back of a friend's pickup truck, if you can believe that. The piano stayed with my dad, and when I was about four, I learned to play it as well, and eventually it made its way to me. In other words, it's old. When we came to this house, I sat down after moving day to play on it, and it was out of tune. I was expecting that, but when I got to around middle C, I heard this thunk, and I thought, well, that can't be good. So I lifted the lid to investigate, and as I suspected, one of the strings had broken, one of the bass strings, so of course it knocked the whole thing out of tune. Well, I can assure you it must have happened during the move, because if it had happened when we were home, we would have heard it. I've been around a piano when that happened before, and it honestly sounds like a legion of demons was let loose. So we called the piano doctor, and he came, and he said, oh, what a beautiful instrument. And then he looked at it, and he said just what I expected. A complete redo of the piano was in order. It had to be completely restrung. And if you're going to do that, since it's such an old piano, the felt needed to be replaced, the action had to be reworked, pretty much everything. So basically, we decided to do all of that so that it would be what it should be, and my piano is now in pieces all over the San Gabriel Valley. We could have just gotten the string replaced, I guess, but that really would not have allowed the piano to be what it was supposed to be. In order to make it what it needs to be, it needed to be completely reconstructed or deconstructed and then reconstructed, remade entirely. So for the moment, my corner is bare, but I'm told that I should have a piano again in about a month, and I can't wait. Our series is called Good News for Troubled Times, and today I want to talk to you about something called the Dark Night of the Soul. The Dark Night of the Soul is an intense depression that is linked to a crisis of faith, a crisis that comes when one senses the absence of God, or gives rise to the feeling of abandonment by him. The term was coined by John of the Cross and was used to describe his own experiences. He was in a period of utter spiritual desolation, disconnected from God, and emptiness where he felt like God wasn't there. Now, I hesitate to broach this subject a little bit because I don't want to give simplistic answers to some very real issues that may be facing you and your family right now. We are in a time of deconstruction for sure. The pandemic has shaken us in terms of what we thought our life was like. And in the midst of all of that, the killing of George Floyd made us all look deep within our souls. And I think, like many of you, I've been really distraught at what I found there. On top of that, as I think of many of you, I am aware that some of you are suffering from health issues and pain that have lingered for years. Some of you have suffered financial hardships and may be facing the loss of your house. Some of you may be wondering where your next meal will come from. And some of you have suffered the deaths of multiple family members and friends. These are real issues facing you now, and I keep them in mind as I speak. You know, churches have generally been practical places. The tendency is to tell people to answer any spiritual problem with more prayer, more serving, more giving, more trying. Well, John of the Cross would say just the opposite. In fact, would say, do nothing. Wait. Remember that we are not God. We do not understand the things of God. Hold on. Ask for help. Do less. Resign from things. Rest more. And if you need to, ask someone to pray for you when you have no words. Psalm 13 is a psalm written by King David during one of his times of deconstruction, and it goes like this. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and day after day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? Look on me and answer, Lord my God. Give light to my eyes, or I will sleep in death, and my enemy will say, I've overcome him. My foes will rejoice when I fall. But I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I will sing the Lord's praise, for he has been good to me. Now, I've always imagined those last lines are said either through gritted teeth or with a bit of sarcasm. Because the first part of the psalm certainly does not sound like God's being very good to King David, nor does it sound like David is rejoicing in a salvation that hasn't come, or trusting in unfailing love that seems to have failed. Deconstruction, dark night of the soul. When God seems silent or absent or just generally disinterested. The dark night of the soul is a period of utter spiritual desolation, disconnection, and emptiness in which one feels totally separated from the divine. Those who experience a dark night of the soul feel completely lost, hopeless, and consumed with melancholy. The dark night of the soul can be likened to severe spiritual depression. I've experienced a dark night of the soul. And I'd like to share a little bit about that experience with you. By way of background, I'll confess I was brought up in an upper middle class home with a religious heritage that was rooted square center in the middle of the evangelical bubble. And there I stayed, happily believing that if I did everything right, God would bless me with health, sufficient wealth to be comfortable, a wonderful family, and basically he would ensure that I experienced the American dream. And for a while I did. Ben and I got married in 1973. We had two children, Melissa and David, shortly thereafter. Ben was a successful contractor and I stayed at home with the kids. And when they went to a private Christian school, I got a job there so we could have free tuition. Eventually we sold our home in Pasadena at a sizable profit and began construction on a dream home in Altadena, nestled between the mansion my mother grew up in and the Altadena Town and Country Club. The plan was to live there happily ever after and be buried under the rose bushes. A friend of ours painted a picture of our house, and here it is. Idyllic. But then 1986 happened. We were still constructing the house. We were living in a townhouse in Arcadia waiting its completion. And I was at the grocery store doing my grocery shopping, and right there and then my world fell apart because Ben interrupted my shopping to tell me that my best friend's husband, Ray, had committed suicide and she needed me to be there with her. I left the groceries and I went, and there I found my friend, her husband still in the basement where he'd hung himself. The paramedics had not yet arrived. She asked me to go down and see for myself, and I went down to pray over him, and I will not describe what confronted me there. Nothing in my life, nothing in my theology or faith had prepared me for that. And right there, I plunged into my dark night of the soul. You see, I knew Ray had suffered from chemical depression. His wife and I and others had prayed for him, and we'd even received impressions that we believed were from God that he would be healed. But he wasn't. He was dead. Well, my friend obviously was incoherent, so I made phone calls for her, arranged with a doctor friend to deliver a prescription for her so that she could sleep, I called Ray's family. I did all the things that one does at a time like that. I took care of her for months, not only staying with her in the evenings, but at work too, because we were co-workers. I prayed for her. I said the right things. I played the piano at Ray's memorial service. I answered all her friends' questions, and I tried to shield her from all the stupid things that people say to widows to make them feel better. I did all that, and I did it on autopilot, because what was going on inside me was this. My faith in God was decimated. My prayer for over a year following Ray's death was, how could you? Why would a loving God let something like that happen? And even more frighteningly, was this nagging thought. Either God let it happen and didn't care about us, or somewhere in his demented plan, he planned it. He caused it. I didn't think I wanted anything to do with a God like that. Well, I sought advice from our pastors at our church and heard a variation on the theme of God works in mysterious ways, and God would certainly never cause something like that to happen. And some even said, you shouldn't feel that way. But to me, whether God caused it or allowed it and chose not to step in and stop it, that was a distinction without a difference. And I was red hot angry at him, to be honest, either way. And if the story stopped here, the conclusion would be, faith doesn't work. Everything I've been taught about God is garbage. And if God actually does love me, I can assure you, the feeling is not mutual. But the story doesn't stop there. Somehow I endured the year-long deconstruction of my faith and my soul. I wrestled with those questions and for months received nothing but crickets in terms of an answer. While I was tempted to give up, I didn't. Why? Because I was too angry at God and I wasn't done giving him a piece of my mind. And that was the only contact I had with him right then. Somewhere along the line, though, I began to sense a still, small voice, annoyingly peaceful, whispering an answer to each of my why questions with, I am. I am. Yahweh. The very breath of God breathing over me. And finally, I was so exhausted with the wrestling that I gave up. I surrendered. And there in that surrendered, helpless, hopeless place, God met me and he began to reconstruct the pile of rubble that my faith had become. A while, but I can say that today I'm thankful for the process. Don't get me wrong, I'm certainly not thankful for Ray's death and the way it happened. That remains to me a complete tragedy and one of the most devastating things I've ever experienced. But I am thankful for the result, because God took a pretty superficial faith and he crushed it. And then he lovingly began to rebuild it from scratch, much like the piano guy's doing with my Baldwin. And in the process, I met God in a new, fresh way, free of preconceptions, misunderstandings, and honestly false teachings that I'd received along the way. Maybe you find yourself in a dark night of the soul now, or something close to it. Dark nights differ from depression. Where depression tends to be more self-focused, dark nights of the soul tend to be more philosophical in nature. They're accompanied by questions such as, why am I even here? Is there a purpose to life? Does God really exist? When depression ends, not much changes in your life in terms of your beliefs, your values, and your habits. But when a dark night of the soul ends, everything around you is transformed, or everything within you is transformed. It leaves a long-lasting impact. The dark night of the soul is really an ego death, where you shed the ego that prevents you from embodying your soul. I've discovered Bob Holmes. He writes a blog called The Contemplative Monk, and it turns out he also has cancer. And he wrote this, I've discovered It's one thing to know God in the great vault of heaven, and quite another to be in the deep, dark pit of depression and feel the breath of light on the back of your neck. For me, my suffering helps me to allow myself to fall apart. I find transformation when my ego shatters, when I die to myself. My pain becomes the place that deconstructs my ego, the ego that hides the light of God's presence like an eclipse of the sun. I think it's important to note that all difficult and tragic circumstances don't result in a dark night of the soul. God will certainly be with you in the midst, but not all difficulties result in the complete deconstruction of your ego and your faith. Nor am I saying that God designs those circumstances to grow you. God did not kill Ray so that Jenny's faith could grow. No, not at all. But in that devastating circumstance, when I came to in a rage of how could yous, God extended an invitation into the deconstruction process. If you find yourself in the dark night of the soul, your desire may be to get out of it as quickly as possible. And I think you certainly may choose to pass on the invitation. God will love you. He will continue to walk with you. He will work with you and through you. But if you do enter the dark night of the soul, there are some things that may be of help to you. First, own your own emotions. It isn't easy to admit some of our emotions. It certainly took me a while to say to anyone that I was angry at God. I mean, you're not supposed to be, right? And even more so, that I sort of hated God, and I thought his plan was stupid, and that his ways of doing things were ridiculous. That's how I felt. But until those words came out of my mouth in the middle of prayer, I don't think I wanted to admit them even to myself. But we feel what we feel, and if we're not honest with God about it, we tend to get stuck in the desolation. Once the words were spoken, it was sort of cathartic. And that's a really nice way of saying it was kind of like vomiting them up and getting them out. Once it's out in the light, God can begin the restoration process. And the operative words there are begin and process, because it takes a very long time. The next thing is to surrender. There came a moment when I realized that holding on to my rage at God was poisoning my soul, and it was doing a job on my family as well. And finally, in more of a state of exhaustion than anything else, I gave up. It's just like all the resistance muscles let go. I think I sort of know what Jacob felt like when he wrestled with God overnight. There's a moment when you realize you're not going to have your way, and there's nothing you can do about it. So you surrender completely. And there was nothing left inside but empty. There was a real sense where I just abandoned myself when I let go. And in a dark night of the soul, as counterintuitive as it is, surrender is the most powerful thing that you can do. Third, avoid self-medication or alcohol to dull the pain. Note that I said self-medication. If you're under the care of a doctor or a therapist and they prescribe an antidepressant, by all means, take it responsibly, follow the directions. God can still get through to you. But those things are best left in the hands of doctors, don't you think, as opposed to our own? Self-medicating may dull the pain for a while, but it really doesn't help the problem, and it actually sets up another barrier between you and God, because you're running to something instead of Him. So get professional help if you need it, by all means. But leave it to the professionals to do the prescribing. Next is practice self-care. Now, when I was going through this, the last thing in the world I wanted to do was exercise, drink water, and eat healthy food. I wanted to curl up in a ball in a dark corner and wallow. But my body needed to be fed, watered, and exercised. It needed to be cared for. More then, I think, than any other time in my life. It is also important to listen to your self-talk. In a dark night of the soul, it's easy to assume there's something wrong with you. You may begin to think of yourself as lazy, broken, weak, what a loser, what a fraud. Rather than that, be kind and gentle to yourself. Be patient. Recognize that this experience is bigger than you are. You didn't cause it, and you can't control it. Be gentle with yourself. Some prayer forms that may be helpful to you in a dark night of the soul are those without words. Centering prayer, meditation, walking, maybe walking the labyrinth if you haven't done that before. Even sitting on a beach and staring at waves could be helpful. If you do have words, do ugly journaling. Just get it all out. It's a good way of processing your thoughts and feelings. Maybe a page after page after page of scribbling. But sometimes there are no words. So again, centering prayer, meditation can be very helpful to you. Next, choose to trust. Choose to persevere. It's a hard choice, but it's one you can make every morning when you get out of bed. And you may need to remake that same commitment several times during the day. And last, find yourself someone to accompany you on the journey. If you are in a dark night of the soul and you have not tried a spiritual direction before, I would highly recommend it. You may be in therapy, but most therapists are not equipped to deal with crises of faith. A combination of a good therapist and a good spiritual director can be a powerful thing. The therapist brings to light what lies beneath, and the spiritual director helps you process it in the context of your faith. If you've never experienced spiritual direction, please give me a call and I'll help you find someone to journey with you. A soul friend, someone who can walk with you through the dark and to help you see. Our theme is entitled, again, Good News for Troubled Times. And I think most people who have gone through the dark night of the soul would agree that the good news is seen in retrospect. But I think they'd also agree on several things. First, God hears us when we cry out to Him. Even in silence, He listens. And more importantly, He hears us. Secondly, God loves us when we yell at Him. Think of King David's Psalms. There's a whole genre of his psalms that are called imprecatory psalms, which are basically David yelling at God. And I suspect that God would rather that we yell at him than just maintain a stony silence. Third, God's presence is absolute and constant. God walks with us through the night, even when we are not aware of his presence. Think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. Who was with them? God was. Psalm 23 says this, "Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil." Why? Because God is with me. Psalm 139, "Where can I go from your presence, Lord? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, there you are. Even there your hand will guide me. Your hand will hold me fast. Even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is like light to you." Fourth, we can be confident in the absolute love of God that protects us from nothing, even as it sustains us in everything. Now let's pause there a second. Did I just say God protects us from nothing? Well, you know, honestly, sometimes He does and sometimes He doesn't. And I can give you scores of instances where tragedies happen to strong believers. And there's Jesus. There's no guarantee that God will protect you from the adverse circumstances of life. And as Wesley, Princess Bride's Wesley, not John Wesley, says, anyone who tells you differently is trying to sell you something. But the important part comes next. We can be confident in the absolute love of God that protects us from nothing, even as that love sustains us in all things. Having gone through a dark night of the soul makes you far less likely to be shaken by future circumstances of life that inevitably come along. It gives you a new bedrock and foundation that is not easily disturbed. In 2013, I had what I thought was a sinus infection. After having it for about 3 weeks, I got pretty sick and I found out it wasn't a sinus infection at all. It was meningitis. I had faced imminent death, and as a matter of fact, had my daughter not taken me to the emergency hospital when she did, I would not be here today. And even scarier than that is after the crisis was over, I faced the possibility of life with brain damage. Because when I got released from the hospital, I couldn't read, I couldn't write, numbers made no sense to me, and I couldn't play the piano. I had no stamina, no strength. Walking from my bed to the restroom required about an hour's worth of recovery time. All of the things that I had ever taken for granted and had done so easily in my life were gone, and the swelling in my brain scrambled the neural pathways that allowed me to do these things. And the doctors gave no guarantee that I would ever recover what was lost. I remember one morning, and I literally crawled down the stairs because I decided I would play the piano or die trying. And the piano's always been something of a comforter and a therapist to me. So I sat down and I put my hands on the keys. And I had the horror of a realization that it might as well be a didgeridoo because I had no clue how to play it. Now, if you don't know me, I actually do play the piano and I play it pretty well. I have a bachelor's degree in performing arts with an emphasis in classical piano. And I've been doing it over 50 years at this point. So not knowing how to play the piano was a bit of a shock. I crawled back upstairs and I lay on the bed for quite a while. And I took stock of what was left of me. It didn't seem like much. And I prayed. But surprisingly, what came out was not, "God, please heal me." It was a prayer of surrender. "God, it seems like everything I have to offer you is gone. My writing, my piano playing, worship, my strength, my mind. There's not much left. But if this is how it's going to be, then would you please show me how to worship you the way I am and give me the grace to accept it?" A peace entered my soul at that point, and it sustained me for the months of recovery. Well, the healing came over time, and God's peace remained. I think having journeyed through the dark night of the soul surrounding Ray's death, I was better grounded in God to face meningitis with God as opposed to on my own. Had I not recovered, I have no doubt that God would have sustained me through it and shown me a way to be. Okay, there would have been some kicking and screaming along the way, I am sure. But God would have lovingly accepted that as well. I'm sure of that. God's priority for us is to be like Jesus, to have unswerving faith and trust in Him, to love ourselves and our neighbors like we love Him, like He loves us, and to be one with one another as displayed in the Trinity. And as much as Jesus used things in and around Him to teach His disciples how to live, God will use the circumstances that surround us, the good, the bad, and the ugly, to refine us and to shape us. Our choice is whether to surrender to the process or to fight against it. It is a brave and terrifying thing in the midst of hard circumstances and tragedy to ask God to take you further in rather than out as soon as possible. To ask God how He might use you, change you, reconstruct you, when everything inside says, "God, just make it feel better." It's a very brave thing indeed. The times we're facing right now, a global pandemic and almost concurrently, global protests against racism sparked by the killing of a black man in Minneapolis. It's an interesting juxtaposition. I wonder if there is an opportunity in the middle of the two tragedies. George Floyd's death, a tragedy in any way of thinking, seems to have hit a deeper chord in most people of all races and backgrounds than have similar tragedies in the past. I wonder if this might be partially due to the fact that we are already a bit off kilter because of the pandemic, and already being somewhat shaken out of our complacency because we didn't have our normal lives to run back to after the current news cycle. Our eyes may have been opened a bit wider than they may have been otherwise, allowing us to stand up and say, "No more." Nothing will take away the pain to George Floyd's family of his untimely and horrible death. Nothing will take away the pain of those who have lost family members and friends to COVID-19 or in the midst of it. And yet some good may arise out of these tragedies. I'm not in any way saying it's worth it. That would be callous. But given the circumstances, if some good can come out of it, if we can all become better people, better neighbors, more loving, more caring, more concerned for the marginalized around us, then please, God, let it rise as a memorial to those who were struck down. Let our lives show that their lives mattered. Let me say this again. God doesn't send the circumstance, but in the midst of it, He offers an invitation to redeem it. And in every circumstance we face, He is present, and we can find Him if we choose to look. Disorientation and deconstruction are uncomfortable and many times unwanted gifts. But when we surrender to God and allow Him to remake us in His image, taking the bits that are most like Him and laying aside those that aren't, we become instruments that He can use for His glory. Like one of my prayers ascribed to St. Francis of Assisi, Lord, make me an instrument of your peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive, it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. I would like to invite you today, in whatever circumstance you find yourself, to commit to the deeper waters, to step out in faith that God is, that God is trustworthy, and that God loves you, and He will never ever leave you or forsake you. His greatest desire is unfettered access to you, to all of you. No walls, no barriers, no hidden places. Where we are completely surrendered to and reliant upon Him for every step we take. And when we do that, we may just find ourselves walking on water. As we end the service today, we will celebrate communion together as our custom. But instead of the standard words of institution that we all know so well, I'd like you to take a moment to consider the circumstances that you are facing or that surround you right now. In the midst of all of it, where are you with God? What questions are surfacing in regard to your faith? For many of you, God may seem far off or even blind. And for at least these few moments, I'd like you to sit with those feelings, as uncomfortable as they are, and allow them to surface. Then as you take the bread and cup, make it a moment of surrender. What is going on in the world today is beyond any of our individual abilities to resolve. The issues may cause us to question ourselves, our beliefs, our faith. If this speaks to you and you find you have no words to express it, I would like to invite you as you take communion to let the words that Shelby sings be your prayer.